So tonight's talk, again, as usual, I haven't got a clue what I was going to speak about when I came in here, but I don't know that before I come in here, there's always people come up and ask a few questions, and someone asked a question on consciousness, and some other people asked a question on different states of being, and of course here we don't want to make it sort of too theoretical, because we want to put these teachings into real life. So I'm going to see if I can weave a talk about nature of consciousness and the colors of consciousness, which are called emotions, and just how they can lead to rebirth in different planes of existence. The whole lot going basically on the nature of consciousness itself. So let's see just how this talk will work. Because consciousness, the knowing, is one of the fundamental parts of our being. We all know that we know, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You'd be in Karakata or Fremantle somewhere. So to be conscious is to be alive. We know that much, but very often we get very confused about what this consciousness is. And especially religions go around talking about a soul, or in Buddhism, stream of consciousness. Some science says that it's only just a manifestation of the brain, it's not really there. And it's very interesting to actually to look deeply about what this thing consciousness is. You all know it is. You all know that you are knowing, you're hearing this, but exactly what is it? So that's what we're going to investigate today. And it's fascinating that in Buddhism, 26 centuries ago, in India, they always had these six types of consciousnesses. We call them the six senses. Of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. But in India, they always had the sixth sense, the mind. And I was doing a little bit of research, a bit of historical research. You know, in ancient Greece, they used to have six senses as well. The same six, even Aristotle, I found out recently. He called that sixth sense, that which actually can take all of the objects of the other five senses of what's seen, what's heard, what's smelt, tasted, what's touched. We can actually know each one of those. He called it the common sense. And actually that's where we get the idea of common sense from in the English language. But it's actually started off as a sixth sense, like the mind. And somewhere along the progression of history, I don't know how it happened, in Western culture, which is supposed to have started from Greece, somehow we lost that sixth sense. I say the West lost its mind. It lost its common sense. And that's why we're here. We've only got five senses left, and that's a problem. And you can see when all we have is what's seen, heard, smelled, tasted, and touched, that's a problem of materialism, isn't it? That's the world of objects and things, sight, sounds, smells, tastes, and physical touches. But it neglects what certainly I think, and what certainly Buddhism says, and what most spirituality says, the most important of the senses is number six, the mind, the consciousness. That, not so much which is hearing and smelling, but what knows that you're doing all of this. And that is called this sixth sense. Now, it is one of the jobs of meditation to actually to investigate this sixth sense, the mind. What actually is this knowing? Because when you meditate, what you're supposed to be doing is not going to sleep. I did hear somebody snoring over there, but we're also compassionate. So, you know, we don't really mind that so much, because sometimes people snore because they're tired. I remember that one occasion, you probably remember one of my favorite stories, I was teaching in Canning Vale, the jail there. I think they call it Casuarina now. And it was a high security jail, and so I always had to have a prison officer with me when I was giving this talk, and we did a meditation, and as we were doing the meditation, I heard someone snoring. And I thought it was one of the prisoners, but when I opened my eyes, it wasn't a prisoner. It was the prison officer, the guard. And when I opened my eyes, already all the other prisoners had their eyes wide open. And they weren't looking at me. They were looking at this bunch of keys. The prison officer had fell asleep. And there were the keys to freedom there. And I remember this very carefully, because they looked at me, they looked at the keys. They said afterwards, it was a very, very close thing. It's only because they thought I'd get into trouble. But sometimes that happens when you sort of meditate, you fall asleep. Actually, you lose your consciousness. And that's not what meditation is all about. It's actually being even more aware than usual. And this is actually what happens, because as one, let's go. What is one actually letting go of? There are two parts to this thing which we call the mind. And I've often talked about this because it's fundamental to one's understanding of meditation, also understanding about who you are. The two parts of the mind is what I call the knowing, that which knows. And the other one is the doer, that which does things. One is the passive part, which can actually receive all the information from the world. And the other one is the reactive part, which responds to what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch. Even responds to what you know. The responder. So one is the active part, the other one which just knows. And what this consciousness is just that knowing, the passive part of the mind. Now, in order to know that, to understand what this is, we've got these two parts of the mind, and they're so interconnected. And you know this from your daily life. Whatever you know, you tend to get involved in. And very often you tend to control and change. So, you know, you go into somebody's house and then you give them all advice on sort of how to, they should have, shouldn't have painted their walls that colour, painted something else. You go to a person's garden, they say, no, you shouldn't have planted that, you should plant something else. Some people even come to our Buddhist centre and tell me what I should be teaching, what I shouldn't be teaching. Why do we always get so involved when it's not our business? Now, see, the point here is when we know something, when we experience it, we always think we should get control of it, we should do something. Just like when you marry your husband. You just know him, that's all. You don't try and control him. But why is it when we get involved in things, we always tend to want to control? We always want to do things. And that is the big problem in life. Too much control, control, control. The control freak syndrome. And every one of you is a little bit of a control freak. Now, in order, when we meditate, we're going in completely the opposite direction of being control freaks. For half an hour, we're letting go. We're letting go of being a control freak. Now, this is one of the problems. It's very difficult to do this, because whatever we know, we tend to want to control. We've got the present moment, first stage of meditation, we want to control the present moment. I don't want to be it this way, I want to be that way. I don't want it sort of to be hot, I want it to be cool. I don't want it to be cold, I want it to be hot. I don't want it to be noisy, I want it to be quiet. We always want to control the content of now, which is fine in ordinary life, but not in meditation. In meditation, we accept this moment as it is. We just know it instead of getting involved. Now, I see the problem here, that too often we get involved when it is none of our business. When it's much better, we just leave things alone. In fact, I think most of the Western problem is we always get involved. We always want to control things and change things and mess things around. If we could only leave it alone, I think life would go on much better. I know that this was a story which was told me. It hasn't been validated yet. I don't know where this person got this, but this came from a monk. He said that he read in a journal that in Israel there was a strike of doctors, I think for about 2 or 3 weeks. And during that period of 2 or 3 weeks, the death rate in all the hospitals in Israel went down dramatically. Now, is that saying something? And I might get into trouble for that if there's any doctors here. But sometimes when we try and control things, sometimes it gets worse. And you know that. Sometimes it's time just to let go, to leave it alone. There's a great skill of spirituality. But the way to be able to do this is actually know the difference between the knower and the doer. Because when they're both together, whatever we know, we want to control. It's as if whatever we know, we think we own. That we own the world. Therefore, because we know the world, we want to change it. If you think you own your partner in life, your wife, you want to change them. If you own your house, you want to change it. If you just rent it, suppose you had like a Holmes West house, then you wouldn't be so concerned about changing it. But if it's your house, my house, then you're very concerned with it. This is why in our monastery we always change the monks' huts around every 2 or 3 years. So they never think they own these places. Even my hut, gets changed around. I went overseas for a couple of weeks. When I came back, the monks had moved all my stuff somewhere else. I thought it was a coup, but it wasn't. They were just sort of teaching me that I shouldn't also be attached to my little room either. It was only next door, but still they were being moved. Now, isn't it a wonderful thing to actually to realize you don't own these things? Then you don't control them. You can accept them as they are and be more at peace with them. So the controller and the doer. The doer is the main problem, not the knower. So in our meditation, what we're actually doing, what meditation truly is calming down the doer. Calming it down until it completely disappears. And so we just know without reacting at all. So we're just sitting here. And whatever we hear is just a noise, that's all. We don't react. As my teacher Ajahn Chah used to say, the noise never disturbs you. It's you who disturb the noise. A pain in your body never disturbs your peace. You disturb the pain. The pain is part of nature. The noise is part of nature. The heat and the cold is part of nature. What do you expect out of life? We try and change most of the time, but in meditation, just try and leave it alone. And that way what happens, this doing thing, this controlling, disappears. And all we're left with is the knowing. Bare consciousness. If we want to know what consciousness actually is, this is how we find out. By isolating it. Just like in chemistry, if you want to know the nature of, you know, silicon or whatever, you've got to make pure silicon without any other ingredients, other trace elements in there, to just that one pure thing, then you can really know it. In the same way, we want to really just know what consciousness is, what this knowing is. This is what we do in meditation. All the doing aside, we just know. And we know. And that way we gather the information of what consciousness truly is. One of the things which you find out with consciousness has different grades to it. Sometimes here we're actually mingling or actually smearing over the word mindfulness as well, which many of you heard in Buddhism. Like mindfulness is almost like pure consciousness, which is not adulterated with any doing. It's just pure knowing, full awareness. And a strange thing happens when you actually start putting all your attention in just to knowing and taking away from this doing business. You find that you get energized. The consciousness becomes bright. When I mean bright, sometimes it's literally that's how you experience it. Like the mind becomes almost brilliant, as if you're seeing a light inside. This is just a strengthening of that consciousness. Because what's happening, again, the energies which you have, so often all those energies get wasted in doing things, in controlling, in striving. And you've got nothing left. Which is why people go asleep sometimes. They've just got nothing left for knowing. So when they start to quieten down, they fall asleep. Ah, poor things. So you're compassionate. They wake up again eventually. So don't have to worry about that. But what especially is that when you actually allow the energies to go into just the consciousness, into pure consciousness and knowing, strange thing happens. You become more alert, more awake, more alive. You get energy in your mind. And that energy in your mind becomes happiness. This is one of the great insights which comes from this tradition, that real happiness is mental energy. The energy of knowing. And that's why you realize why a lot of people get depressed in this day and age. Because they've got no energy left for their consciousness. It all goes into doing. We strive so hard in this life. The old rat race. Instead of the human race. And this is one of our problems. That, you know, we're doing so much. Even to get here we have to strive so much. Even as a monk, I have to do so much, but I just said, went on 2 weeks holiday. 2 weeks holiday in my hut on retreat. Oh, that's really nice. Not doing anything at all. Just sitting there, eating, sleeping, sitting and walking. That's all I did for 2 weeks. Isn't that very nice to do? Could you do that? Could you? Sometimes they say, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have nothing to do? and give you 10 minutes of nothing to do and say, I want to do something. You get bored out of your skulls because you just don't know how just to do nothing. So this is what I was doing. And when you do nothing, you get bright, you get energized. And I've noticed this so often, that where did all that energy come from? It's the energy of your being. And it's not wasted in sort of striving and doing. You're taking time off, you re-energize yourself, and then consciousness becomes bright. And when consciousness becomes bright and powerful, not only gives you great happiness, but it also gives you great insight. You're seeing deeply. It's as if you realize that if consciousness is like, using a metaphor, looking through the window of your car, sometimes that windscreen is just so dirty that it really needs a good wash to get all the rubbish off, all the oil and dust. And once you give it a good wash, you can actually see the road clearly. And you realize it wasn't the road which was dull, it was your screen was dull. That's all you need to do to clean the screen up. And once you've cleaned that screen up, as if when you've cleaned the mind of all this doing and worrying and being afraid or being planning and all that sort of stuff, all the doing stuff, you find your mind becomes very, very bright and you see very deeply and see very happily as well. I think I mentioned this maybe last time, that is a strange thing. Whenever you go on a retreat, like I just did, it's amazing. You tend to, you know, to want to eat less, but you find out sometimes you eat more because the food gets more delicious. I noticed this even the first time I went on a retreat. Why is it when on retreats the food gets very delicious? It's just ordinary food, but when you meditate, when you stop all this doing business, the mind gets very bright. You find because of the alertness there, you can pick up more of the taste. So that's why I say that if any of you ever go out to a restaurant at night, meditate for half an hour beforehand and you'll enjoy your food much, much more. You'll get your money's worth. It's just like you're cleaning up your minds and preparing your palate so you can really enjoy what you're going to eat. So what actually you're doing, you're getting that happiness and clarity. Once you get that happiness and clarity, especially you start to notice the nature of consciousness. It's not just one thing, it's six things, just like the Buddha said. Six different types of consciousness. Seeing is not the same as hearing. Hearing is not the same as smelling or tasting or touching. But there is something similar there, isn't there? When you hear me, when you see me, there's something similar there, which is why we all call this a type of consciousness. But really, what's happening there, and you see this very clearly when your mind becomes very strong and alert, what's actually happening? You're hearing something, and then the mind knows it heard. The mind takes up what's heard as its own object. It's like the hearing sense comes up first and the mind sense comes up second, right afterwards. Or when you feel something in your body, you feel it and then the mind knows it felt something. The mind comes up next. You see that in the way that our conscious process happens, the six types of consciousness, this is actually all it is. It's a sequence of discrete moments of knowing. First the eye knows, then the mind knows. Or the body knows, and then the mind knows. And this is actually how knowing happens. This mind consciousness follows on the other five senses. That's why even Aristotle called it the common sense. It arrives afterwards. Whatever you feel, then you know you felt it. Whatever you smell, you know you smelt it. Whatever you hear, I know that lady coughed. I heard it, and then my mind knew it. And even what you know, then the mind knows that you knew. This is a sequence of conscious activity. What it is, in one of my talks, I once described it as looking on a beach, a strand of sand. When you look, if you go down Cottesloe and you see that beach there, you think that it's continuous. But if you look more closely, you find that that continuous beach of sand is actually made up of individual particles. And those individual particles are actually separated. There's a space between them. If you look very closely with a microscope, you see those pieces of sand aren't even touching. Between them is space. In this simile, those grains of sand are like the moments of consciousness. Sight, hearing, mind consciousness, any of those six, you find they're sequential. They're not continuous. If you look very carefully, you'll find there's a space between them. The emptiness of existence. Now when you actually start to know what actually consciousness is, you also start to see, again using the simile of the beach of sand, you see that sometimes the waves wash in and they bring all this flotsam and jetsam, I think the word is, all this pollution, sometimes like oil on the beach, and that covers the sand in this grime. Or sometimes another wave may come up and clean up that sand. Sometimes these moments of consciousness are polluted by the stuff swirling in the ocean. These conscious moments have what we call colour. I call those colours the emotions. Everything you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, even know, is influenced by the state of mind, the emotions. These are the things which will wash up onto the shore, which is your mind. When these things wash up, you see they colour the consciousness. And it's interesting when you do this, because you start to see that what you hear is not really what is really pure there. You're hearing also what you've been conditioned to hear. It is something which you really don't like to hear, some type of music which you really hate. Now whenever you hear that, there comes up that negativity. That's not really just in the music, that's just what you add to it. The pollution which covers the pure particles of sand of your consciousness. And there's other emotions which come up, such as emotions of kindness and love, which are beautiful emotions. It's just they've been just washed pure and lovely by the beautiful sand. Now this is actually interesting to see this, because you find that consciousness is not pure consciousness. It always has these emotions with it. And sometimes people wonder about what is the place of those emotions and where they come from. Because it's the emotional world which eventually causes us happiness or suffering in this world. The states of consciousness. And somebody was actually asking me, just again, this is why it comes up, asking me at lunchtime today. He said, all of these emotions which come up, that they said they were doing some chanting and they got all this happiness. And he said, is this normal? If you're doing like Buddhist chanting, you get happiness coming up. And is this good? Should I be carrying on doing this? He said, this is just like those waves have just been washing over your consciousness. And they're beautiful waves. Because you know that it feels good. It's pure, it's lovely when you have emotions of inspiration, of joy and happiness. Whenever you have kindness in your heart, and you do an act of kindness, it brings this wonderful sense of beauty in the heart. These are the emotions, the positive emotions. I told this lady that when you talk about the conscious world, it can be coloured either way, with the positive emotions of selflessness, compassion, kindness, inspiration, peace is a positive emotion. And these are ones which we encourage. And you know this because you feel this inside yourself. The negative emotions like jealousy. You know, why did she become enlightened rather than me? I've been coming to this Buddhist center much longer than she has, and she became enlightened on her first night. It's not fair. Whatever it is, the jealousies or whatever. Or fears or the anger. Those are the negative emotions. And this is where we come into the real life, because these are the things which really affect the way we live our lives. We have to know those emotions, know the colouring of consciousness, and understand exactly where they come from and what benefit they are, where they lead to, where they come and where they go to. Because once you see where they go to, you first of all know the difference between what I call the positive emotions and the negative emotions. It's what they result in makes them good or bad. You know that this idea of good or bad, positive or negative, it's not something which you learn from a monk. It's not something which is written in a book. Buddhism is not a scripture-based religion. It's got its own scriptures, and you can go to the library and get all the books out, but those are only pointers. That's not the truth. It's the menu. It's not the food. The food is what you're experiencing now. And that's why that just whatever you actually read or whatever you hear from monks like me, they're not to be taken as absolute truths, because a signpost is never absolutely absolute proof. It's pointing to absolute proof. And the absolute proof is known for yourself in your heart. So you're feeling this consciousness, you're knowing, you're coming much closer to what we call Dhamma, to truth, to reality, through your knowing. And this is where you know what those consciousnesses feel like. First of all, to get to real knowing of what the emotions are, stop giving them names. Because names are purgative. All the names have got carry these meanings. Oh, this must be bad, this must be good. When you don't give it a name, you just know it, you feel it, you come much closer to the truth of it. This is why in the meditation, to really get to know, you give up all the names. So you can truly know how you feel. When there's inspiration or things which is close to inspiration, you can't actually just give it a name, because sometimes it's inspiration, it's also love, sometimes it's brightness, it's happiness, it's joy, it's bliss or whatever. Just the names are just makeshift. And that's what it does. It makes you shift. It moves you from the experience. And so we leave the names alone. So we just know. When we talk about love, do we really need to know what the name is? We can feel it in our hearts. So this is what the purpose of this knowing and clear mindfulness is. To know it for ourselves. As a feeling, as an emotion inside of ourselves. You don't need to give it a name. That's why all the books can sometimes be misleading. They're great as pointers. They're very useful. But don't stop at the books. We don't argue over menus in Buddhism. We eat the food. And so when you actually start to know what these emotions are, you start to feel which emotion is really good, which is really bad. It's really strange that sometimes this means a person has to trust themselves rather than trust the teacher. And I said here many times before that any good teacher, any good guru is supposed to be trying to get rid of their disciples. I've been trying for years to get rid of some of you and you still keep coming back. I want an easy life. I want Friday evenings off. But what do you mean by getting rid of people? It means that so you know for yourself. So you don't need the signposts. Because you've gone to the destination. You don't need the books. The books are there for you to read so you can know yourself, not to be carrying the books on your head all the time. That's why the Buddha gave the simile of the raft. He said, like a person wants to cross from one side of a stream or one side of a body of a water for another, to the other side. When you're crossing, you can make a raft to cross, but the raft is only for crossing. You don't use it to carry it after you've crossed. You don't carry it on your head afterwards. In the same way, the books are there for knowing. For yourself, your own experience. And this is actually, you see, that all wise teachers eventually give up the books because they go to the experience. In fact, the real book, the real scripture, is written inside of you, in your heart, your experience. And through this knowing, we actually come to that experience, the experience of what these emotions truly are. And you'll know intuitively which are the good ones and which are the bad ones, because you see where they result. If you have anger, sometimes we have this strange expression in the West, righteous anger. It's one of these another oxymorons. I like the word moron because it is really moronic to actually to say such things. Say it's righteous, they needed to be told off. They didn't need to be told off, just they needed to change their way. They needed to actually see their faults, but to tell it off, do they really need to be told off? Do you need to be told off? What's it like when you're told off, when you're the victim of anger? Does that really help you? Every time that someone got angry at me, I just didn't respect them anymore, number one. And number two, I just tried to avoid them. I didn't trust them anymore. A real good teacher, at least for me anyway, ones were kind. I realized that they had my interests at heart. And you don't need to be angry to get the best out of another person or to change them. So, you know, anger, whenever I've looked at it, I can never see any point to it, basically. That's my experience anyway. Don't trust me, though. Find out for yourself. You know, whether anger actually works in your life. Someone's hurt you, they've done the wrong thing, you get angry at them. That emotion, what does it lead to? What it leads to is divorces. What it leads to is guilt. What it leads to is loneliness. Eventually it leads to depression. If you get angry at somebody else, you eventually get angry at yourself for all your faults, and you can't live with yourself anymore. And you can get divorced from a husband or a wife, you can get, you know, leave home, get rid of your parents and leave your children, but you can never get rid of yourself. Wherever you go, you take you with you. So you're stuck with you. And don't think when you die you're going to escape. We believe in reincarnation. You're stuck with you after death as well. You're stuck with you all the way to enlightenment. So you try all sorts of strategies to try and escape from yourself. Even you go and get drunk or get stoned on drugs. You're there afterwards. And you have to face yourself. You are with you. And so, anger eventually gets to anger oneself. And that's just a stupid thing to do. Why would anybody, anger is wanting to hurt someone else. Why would anybody want to hurt themselves? It's complete stupidity, but a lot of people do that. Why would anyone not allow themselves to be happy? A lot of people do that. A lot of people just would not allow themselves to enjoy themselves, to be really happy. What a stupid thing. What's wrong with being happy? It's not against the law. You don't have to pay a tax, a happiness tax, when you're happy. Every time you smile, that's another 10 cents to the government. Thank you very much. It's free. And so what we're saying here, you can actually know what the emotions are and their benefit for you. Everyone knows that any moment of happiness, a smile, a laugh, sort of is good for your health, improves your immune system, makes you more attractive, everything. So I think I gave a talk over in Armidale the other day. I said, look, these talks which you give here, because you make you laugh, it makes you sort of happy, make you smile. Number one, it makes you beautiful. So this is a beauty parlor. This is not a Mara beauty parlor. Number two, it increases your life. So it's a health clinic as well. What are the other things he was doing? Number three, it makes you have more energy in life, so you create more wealth. It's a wealth creation seminar here. Because they say actually that happiness, contentment is the highest wealth. That's what Buddha's saying. So it is a wealth creation seminar. There's so many good things, and you know it's really good. When you are happy with yourself, you can be happy with others. It's good for your relationships. You don't have so much problem finding a partner in life and keeping that partner and keeping harmony in your home. Don't you like to be with happy people instead of misery, guts always sort of complaining all the time? And so this is actually great for everything. So actually you can know this is just an example of like happiness or inspiration. Just what a great benefit that is to you, to your family, to your career, to your business, or whatever else you're doing in life. So certainly it's a great benefit for being a monk, being happy and smiling and making people laugh during talks, and people keep coming here and they keep giving more donations. Without that, I'll be in big trouble. They keep feeding me. So it's been a great benefit to me. But anyway, that happiness, you can see its positive benefit, and you can see the negative benefit of the negative emotions. That's why we call them negative. That you don't need to read that in a book. You don't need to hear that. You need to trust that in yourself. But my goodness, people don't trust themselves. That's why they keep coming to places like this to get it confirmed. So you know for yourself. That's basic Buddhism. I'd even say in Pali, Pachatangwe Ditabo Winyuhi. That's what you just chanted, those who were in the chanting before. To be known each wise person for themselves. To know these things. When you know the things, you know the different types of emotions. When you know those different types of emotions, you know these ones should be cultivated, these ones should be let go of. How do you let go of those colors of the consciousness, the negative emotions? And how do you cultivate the positive ones? Now, instead of looking at the results, you look at their causes. Where do these things come from? Why do I get angry? Why do I get jealous? But don't just look at the negative ones. Why do I get happy? Why do I feel good? We start to look at the causes. The effects tell us what's good, what's bad, what's positive, what's negative. The causes show us where these things come from. And once you start to see where their things come from, there you get some idea of how to let go through wisdom, through understanding the causes. When you understand the causes, you can actually stop and avoid the causes for, say, getting angry. One of the ways to stop getting angry is to rest a bit more. Don't be so hard upon yourself physically. We run around so much, we don't give ourselves enough time to rest, not even enough time to play. It's a big thing in my monastery, or when I have meditation retreats, I always encourage people to have play time. You know, meditation retreats can be so serious, and some monasteries can be so serious, and they're not fun. But when there's no fun, you find the mind doesn't leap towards a task. And you find the meditation doesn't go well, and the monastery doesn't sort of survive. Everyone gets just too tense and upset. So I always like to have playtime. I think it would be great in every corporation, every business, whether you're a secretary or a CEO, just like you did when you were at school, to have 5 minutes in the morning or 5 minutes in the afternoon of playtime. When you can go on the swings, have a bit of a lark around. And then afterwards you find out that you do much, much better in your sort of corporate dealings or being a nurse or whatever if you have a bit of playtime. Do you understand what I mean? You're letting go. You're just relaxing, putting a bit of brightness in the day, a bit of playtime. You find out that if you don't have playtime, don't have a bit of fun and joy, you find you get angry, you get bitter, you get negative, you even get depressed. Because there's no fun in your workplace. There's no fun in your home. There's no fun in your monastery. There's no fun in your life. So be careful of having a bit of playtime every now and again. Sometimes when I first became a monk, I thought monks were going to be really, really serious. But some of the sort of the stuff that goes on in the monastery, I wouldn't sort of be embarrassed to sometimes tell you about. You know, I'll tell you about in our library. In our monastery, we've got all these books. We've got the Buddhist Tripitaka, all these other great treatises on Buddhist psychology. But in the cupboard round the back, it's got a sign on it, monks only. If you open the cupboard at the back there, you've got all the comic books. Calvin and Hobbes is a favourite. And what's the other one? Looney. We've got a new Looney cartoon book. Great stuff. Monks are really into that. And why do they do this? Why do serious monks, celibate, only eating once a day, just being so severe, why do they have... We do need a bit of playtime. You need playtime too. So when you have a bit of playtime, what it is doing is creating that bit of happiness and joy in the life. It's a positive emotion. You get that less seriousness, that less anger, that less... We call it like a fault-finding mind. It's one of these other great names in Buddhism, fault-finding mind. Sometimes we develop a mind which always looks for faults in things. You're not sitting right. You should be more alert. You shouldn't sort of be making that noise. You shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be doing that. That fault, and me, I shouldn't be speaking like this either. I should be giving a much better talk than this. Why am I giving the same old talk again, Ajahn Brahma? I'm really horrible. I've given up that fault-finding mind a long time. I couldn't stand myself to have that fault-finding mind. So we give up that fault-finding mind. So we see the causes of these emotions. That way of consciousness which makes that consciousness move in that direction. And once we see those causes, we can actually stop them. You can say, I'm getting to fault-finding again. What should you do when you get into fault-finding? The opposite of fault-finding is metta, loving-kindness. It's unconditional. Which means... you're not actually judging at all. You're letting go of all of that. It's interesting, that judging business. The measuring, which is what part of that fault-finding mind. We are great measurers. And this is actually what we've been taught, even by science. Imagine what it's like if we gave up measuring for a little while. Because that's also what we do in meditation. When you stop the words, You stop all the measuring. Very few people can do this, but it's a very easy way into deep meditation. Just to sit there and stop all the measuring. Good meditation or bad meditation, that's measuring. Shut up. Even shut up or talking, that's measuring. Imagine having no measurements at all. You can't find fault anymore when you're not judging and measuring. Imagine what would happen. The mind would stop. Instead of the mind going off into doing things, it wouldn't be able to do anything at all. This is actually came from a question which somebody gave a year or two ago during the Saturday afternoon meditation. They knew I had a science background, and so they quoted this scientist, Lord Kelvin. And Lord Kelvin, one of the founders of modern science, especially he's into thermodynamics and especially technology. He said, in order to control, you have to first of all learn how to measure accurately. And that's science. We've learned how to measure accurately everything. And that's called technology. But I turned it around. What would happen if you did it the other way around? He said, in order to control, you have to measure first of all. What would happen if you didn't measure at all? You wouldn't be able to control. You'd let go. You'd have no choice. Imagine if you didn't measure your husband, your wife. You stopped measuring them. You wouldn't be able to control them anymore. You would be unmeasured, or what we sometimes call unconditional loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter who you are. I'm not going to measure you. I'm not going to find fault, find praise. I'm not going to judge you at all. Unmeasured love. That's why those of you who know a bit about Buddhism know that the Buddha called those states the immeasurable states, the immeasurable attainments, the apamana states. Because we're not measuring anymore. When you don't measure, you don't control, you let go, you're free. And this is actually one way of developing these beautiful positive emotions. You're actually colouring consciousness in a beautiful way. And after all these measurements, where do they all come from anyway? Who made all these measuring scales? All of you about, I'm peaceful or not peaceful. What is that anyway? Well, as soon as you have that scale, then you're not peaceful. As soon as you start measuring your meditation, it's never good enough. It never reaches this at the top of the scale, because there's always another peak, something more. Imagine if you stop measuring it. What you actually say is, this is good enough. It's this is good enough meditation. My husband, he is good enough. Now come on, he is good enough. Okay. So you got fault finding mind. My wife is good enough. My monk is good enough. I am good enough. Can you say that to yourself? Stop measuring yourself. Unconditional loving kindness. Then you are not colouring your consciousness with fault finding anymore. You're finding that this thing we call consciousness is now being freed. When it gets free, it realizes peace, and peace becomes happiness. As I said earlier, when all of the energy goes away from doing, just into knowing, to pure consciousness, pure mind, pure knowing, without doing anything, then you're sweet. Then you're very, very happy. When you don't do anything, it's as if there's nothing to do, as if, hey, the world is perfect and I'm perfect. Whenever there's imperfection, there's always something to do. Whenever it's perfect, there's nothing to do. Wouldn't you like to do nothing now and again? Wouldn't you like to have a holiday? Wouldn't you like to be free and have a good rest? Why is it that we can't have a rest when we go home? Because there's always something to do. Why in your spiritual life can't I ever become enlightened? Because there's always something to do. And why is there always something to do? Because you always think you're not perfect enough. It's not good enough. My house isn't good enough. I'm not rich enough. How many of you are rich enough? Are you rich enough yet? How much more do you want? Is your house big enough yet? How many of you are contemplating extensions? Have you had enough children yet? How much more do you want? So that's all because of discontent, fault finding. And that colours consciousness. Imagine colouring consciousness with a sense of freedom. This is good enough. Maybe out there in the world you've got to still do things and strive, but in your spiritual life, in your home, in your mind, imagine not colouring consciousness at all. It means you've taken away volition, the doer. When you take that away, you find you have a bit of peace. You're not disturbing the world. You're accepting it as it is. It's perfect. It's good enough. You're not measuring it. You're free. That's why we meditate, to experience this beautiful sense of freedom. Even though there's still things to be done, not now, this is good enough. When you look at it, this life of yours, how much have you already done? How hard have you worked? You really strived, each one of you. When are you going to take a day off? Not a day off, when are you going to take a moment off? A moment of peace, saying this is good enough, I've worked hard enough, now I can just sit down and be at peace with myself. Instead of always being on a journey. Always being on a journey somewhere, sometimes in life we're on a journey, you know, in our relationship, in our career, in our search for wealth. Sometimes you come in here and you're still on a journey, on a spiritual journey. But why is it so many people on a journey and never anyone is actually sitting down and taking a rest? When you sit down and take a rest, then you're not on the journey anymore. You're at the goal. What is the result of a spiritual journey? It's to get peace. Isn't that what you're coming here for peace? And people working so hard for peace. Working so hard for peace, you never find it. So stop working hard in your spiritual life. Stop working. Stop. Then you find all the peace you could ever want in the world. I'm going to finish off with one of my favorite stories. It's the story of the donkey and the carrot. I tell this story during the meditation retreats. It's usually like the very end. Because it's a very, very strange thing that many times, that this is actually in the old books. Many times that people, even in the time of the Buddha, would strive so hard to get enlightened, they never get enlightened. And they give up. Just like the Buddha's attendant, Ananda. He strives so hard to get enlightened because the story was that just after the Buddha passed away, they're going to have this big meeting to try and actually get all the teachings together. Like a big conference. 500 monks met together. 499 of those monks were fully enlightened. All arahats, perfect beings. And there was one left out, and that was Ananda. Imagine if that was you. Imagine if there was, maybe say 300 people in this room, and they say, one of you is not enlightened, that's you. How do you feel? Oh, this is really hard. And he was actually going to be at the conference the next morning. And so he decided, right, this is it, tonight, enlightenment or bust. He really worked hard that night, trying so hard to become enlightened. And this was the famous Ananda, the Buddha's chief attendant. You know, being with the great teacher, next to him, looking after him, getting all these secret teachings, special attention. About, I think, 25 years he held that post. And with all he knew, at the end of the night, when the dawn came, he was still far from being enlightened. He wasn't getting anywhere at all. You know how it's sometimes those people who've been on retreats, what it's like? meditate, you try so hard, you get nowhere. Be coming here year after year, think, what am I getting out of this? Getting nowhere. That's how he felt. But he decided, okay, that's it. I'm going to let go. He decided to have a quick rest before the meeting. And according to the story, before his head hit the pillow, he was the 500th enlightened monk. He became enlightened. Another story, there was a nun in the time of the Buddha, and she, the name was Siha. And she, again, been a nun for, I think, 7 years, and never got a moment's peace. Trying really hard, so she thought, I don't want to go and disrobe. I don't want to go back to that life. But then I can't stay as a nun anymore. I'm just getting no peace at all. So, she took a rope. She went into the wood. She climbed a tree, tied one end of the rope to a branch of the tree, and tied another around her neck. And she was just about to jump off. She let go, and she became another enlightened being, just in time. Now that is not a meditation method we recommend in this place. Please do not try it, otherwise the Buddhist Society of West Australia will be sued in the courts if it don't work. Now those are two fascinating stories. Why did they happen? And to explain it, it's a simile of the donkey and the carrot. Because many of you who may have been to like southern Europe, where they used to have donkey carts. And these donkey carts, they'd be arranged like this, have a cart. And this was actually before they had motor cars, and so they'd use these donkey carts to actually to pull people and to pull, produce from one place to another. But you know, donkeys are very, very stubborn animals. And even if you hit them, they sometimes won't move. So they have to be smart. So what they used to do is they'd tie a stick to the cart, and it would be longer than the donkey's head. And just at the end of the stick, they'd tie a rope. On the other end of the rope would be a carrot. About a foot or 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. A nice big juicy carrot. So the donkey would see that carrot, would move towards the carrot. Now to eat it. Greed, desire. But because it was tied to the cart, as the donkey moved, the carrot would move. Didn't matter how fast the donkey went, the carrot would also move in front of it. And that's how they got the stupid donkeys to pull the carts. However, they don't have donkey carts in south of Europe now, because now there's many Buddhists have gone to south of Europe, and they've taught the donkeys how to catch the carrot. Because the Buddhist donkey knows how to catch carrots, because they know what enlightenment is, know how to let go. What a Buddhist donkey does, they see that carrot in front of them. They tried it before, they walk towards it, the carrot moves away, they run towards it, doesn't matter how fast they run, the carrot runs the same speed in front of them. So the Buddhist donkey sees that carrot and runs like hell after it, putting absolute full effort into running after that carrot. And of course, no matter how fast the Buddhist donkey runs, the carrot goes the same speed in front. But this is what makes it a Buddhist donkey. The Buddhist donkey knows how to stop, how to let go. And so suddenly the donkey stops. Now of course you need faith, because as soon as you stop, that carrot goes even further away. And you think, oh, it's not working. The meditation doesn't work. It's not for me. Something wrong. I'm doing it wrong. Because you see, enlightenment goes even further away from you. But you're patient. That's one of the great things with spiritual people. They're not patient enough. They want to get enlightened now. If this place, you don't get enlightened this evening, you go to some other place. But he's got patience, this donkey. Because the Buddhist, he's wise, he's smart, he's heard the talk before. And it goes as far as any cow has ever been away from this donkey. Huge distance. You think it's getting nowhere, in fact, getting much worse. But you're patient, and then it gets so far away it starts coming back again. First, very slowly, but it picks up. You don't do anything. You just sit there and watch. And this donkey, this carrot, starts to come towards you. In a short while, it's back to its normal position, about 2 feet in front of you. But this time, it's not standing still, it's not moving away. This time, it's moving towards you. And all you need to do is just at the right moment, open your mouth. You don't even need to grab the carrot. The carrot comes into you. Now that's how the Buddhist donkeys catch the carrots. And that's why, because there's so much Buddhism in southern Europe now, they don't have donkey carts anymore. They've sussed it all out now, how to catch these carrots. Now that's how you catch the carrot of enlightenment. You stop. You've already been running so hard. This last week, how many things have you been doing? You've been running so hard in life to get your happiness, to get your wealth, to do your jobs, do your responsibilities. Now you learn how to stop. Consciousness stops. And the carrot of happiness comes towards you. Craving, the Buddha said, desire, wanting, is always running after the carrot. Running after the carrot of life. Nice relationship, a nice beautiful husband, a nice beautiful wife, a nice kids, a nice house, wealth, the carrots of life. You've been running so hard after those things all your life. Have you ever got that carrot? It's always just that little piece in front of you, isn't it? Happiness is almost there, but it's always in front of you, like the carrot in front of the donkey. You've been running so hard already. Now you learn how to stop. When you really stop, when you start doing this, the carrot goes further away. You think, oh, it's getting worse and worse, but you got faith. You let go, and you stay letting go. And after a while, the carrot of happiness comes towards you. You realize you don't have to do anything in life. Just sit here, like as monks. I don't go out and work. I don't even cook. I just open my mouth and people put food in. Well, not quite my mouth, I open my bowl. And then people put food every day in the monastery. Just open the bowl and put me food. See, I don't go out looking for food. Food comes to me. And this is what enlightenment does, what happiness does. So you can actually understand the way to actually get those beautiful emotions, how to colour consciousness in a beautiful way. And the different realms of existence, this is what makes the different realms. Because consciousness goes to its place. It fits into certain places. Those negative consciousnesses, consciousnesses of anger, always go into hellish realms. The beautiful consciousness of love go into heavenly realms. No, of fear, of gluttony, goes to the realms of the hungry ghosts. The love goes into the Brahma heavens. You can see just each little consciousness goes into a different place. I don't know if I told it. Somebody asked me to tell this story a week or two ago. Maybe I can. Nice place to put this in now. You know the beautiful story of the samurai who went to ask the monk whether it's heaven or hell? Do you believe in heaven or hell? An afterlife, going to hell or going up to heaven? And this samurai many years ago came up to this monk and said, "Monk, sort of, I know that you won't lie. You're very, very wise. You know, you got all these precepts you keep, and one of them is you're always going to be honest. So I'm going to ask you straight. Now, I want to answer me straight. Is there heaven or is there hell?" Other people, they may say these things, they can't believe them, but maybe you, I might believe. Is there heaven or hell? And this monk said, "Look, you're too stupid to even understand the meaning of those words." And calling a samurai are very proud and noble warriors, calling them stupid is the wrong thing to say. So this samurai got very upset and offended. He said, "Look, you shouldn't talk to a noble samurai like me." And the monk looked at him and said, you're just probably just a peasant farmer. Now, you can't think yourself as a samurai. That's a noble profession. People like you can't become samurais. And that was an insult. And so this samurai said, "See this sword here?" And he started pulling it out of its sheath. "This is so sharp, just with a quick swish, I could cut off your head." And the monk said, "You couldn't even cut butter with that rusty old blade." And that was it. The samurai got out his sword, was about to cut off the monk's head. And the monk said, "Now that's hell." And the samurai understood. The anger inside of him, just the being feeling insulted, he realized that's what hell feels like. And he realized that that was a trick of the monk to teach him what the real meaning of hell is. Not in words, but an experience. That's an experience of hell. Every time you get angry at someone, you are in hell. That's what it feels like. And so this monk realized, sorry, this samurai realized he'd actually found a real monk at last, someone who could really teach him, not just all this jargon and mumbo jumbo, but teach him through experience. And so he was so grateful. He put away his sword and he started bowing at this monk's feet. He said, "Oh, thank goodness at last I met a wise person. Now I understand what hell is." And the monk smiled at him and said, "Now you're in heaven." And that's what actually heaven and hell mean. That's a conscious state. So if a person died when they're angry, you probably go down to a hell realm. Because that's where you belong. If you're greedy, you go to the realms of the hungry ghosts, because that's where your consciousness belongs. If you die when you have love in your heart, you go to the heaven realm, because that's where your consciousness belongs. If you have peace in your heart, you go to the peaceful realms, because that's where your consciousness belongs. So of all these different realms of existence in Buddhism, all suited for the different types of consciousness which you can have, the different levels of consciousness. And that's how you get reborn in those places. You go to where you belong. I sometimes wondered that when I was young in London. Because sometimes, you know, before I was a monk, I'd go out with my friends. Sometimes you go out to a pub. And always, I'd always tend to go to the quiet pubs. And sometimes people go to these pubs and you know there'd always be a fight every night. People go and get drunk, they'd always have sort of a fire. And I wonder, why on earth do people go to such places? They go to such places because they want to, because they like fighting. Different types of consciousnesses go to different places. This evening, a lot of people have gone to Northbridge for a fight. But your consciousness have come to the Buddhist center in Nonamara for some Dharma, you see, so you're already very close to heaven. So you see, different consciousnesses go to different places. And it's the same as after death. Once you know what that consciousness is, you can actually see that the mind consciousness, different than the other five consciousnesses, is not dependent upon your body. So seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is dependent on the body. Mind consciousness is independent. That's why when your body dies, your mind consciousness is still there afterwards. Once you see that in your meditation, you know what rebirth is as a fact. The six types of consciousnesses, because the West lost its common sense, lost its mind, its sixth sense, that's why they stopped believing in reincarnation or rebirth. Once you understand what the mind is, you include that sixth sense, then you know what rebirth is. And you know how rebirth and different realms of existence. You know what consciousness is, and you also know how you color consciousness with your wisdom. Know the results of kindness, inspiration. That's good. Cultivate it. That's happiness. That's beauty. Cultivate it. So the negativity, fault-finding, anger, sort of being mean, being selfish, you know what that hurts. So find its causes and do away with those causes. So you become a person with a beautiful consciousness. And then you know what heaven is. You know what hell is. So, that is my talk this evening on consciousness and everything else. So, that's just again off the cuff once again. So, any questions about the talk this evening? Any questions? Comments? Going, going, gone.